Well, I'm going to make a controversial comment. I don't think the real world is linear feedbacks and straight lines. Have you know that things are not asymptotic? Just to take another example.
If you could flesh that out a little bit more for me, that'd be helpful.
Well, you're saying that as I drop real wages, I have a linear response in employment that keeps increasing. And I think the curve should be asymptotic. It won't keep increasing. It cannot. It's going to level off as you approach a maximum. And I come at this as a scientist. And the real world is seldom straight lines. When we're doing modeling in science of various things, global cycles of element cycling for environmental science, things have nonlinear feedbacks, and you need more complicated mathematics to handle things.
So, as general, I think it's a great point. I guess I'll say two things about that. One is that you wouldn't want to be led by the fact that you use straight lines in these pictures to think the underlying model was linear. In fact, it's not. But with that said, I think there's probably a number of feedbacks that you would like to see in the model that I don't have. I think the way we try to approach things in economics is take a simple model, see where it's not working well, and then build on it and augment it. And to the extent that building in the kind of nonlinear feedbacks you have in mind will be helpful in explaining some aspect of the data that we can't otherwise explain, we should definitely augment it. I actually had the privilege of working with Jose Shankman at the University of Chicago, who's one of my on my thesis committee, one of my thesis advisors, and he was very interested in trying to think about how to model and think about chaotic dynamics inside of economic models. And one of the challenges we faced, at least the aggregative level, maybe if we got more down into the micro level, you could see it more. At the aggregate level, it was hard to see the role of those nonlinearities. Doesn't mean they're not there, especially the kind of extreme event we've just gone through. They might be playing an important role. But that's the way we try to argue in economics, is by trying to identify the places where our models are failing and then build on them as best we can. But the straight lines here are simply expositional convenience. I could draw them curves, and we would get very similar kind of answers.
Yeah. I notice you don't include anything about Milton Friedman and his theory on markets and economic policy. So in this case, as you go into hyperinflation, what happens to your model? Because the expansion of the money supply over the last, since 2008, has been unbelievable. How do you rein that in without falling off the cliff?
So this is a great question. So the question was about the expansion of the money of the monetary base in particular since 2008, and how do we rein in those potential inflationary forces? So I'll start from an observation of the data. Inflation has been at 2%.
You're excluding energy and food.
No, I'm not actually. These are
headline measures of PC inflation.
I'm getting closer to 7-8%.
Yeah, in the data that both in the CPI consumer price index and in the personal consumption expenditure measures of inflation, they have stayed near 2%. But I think the concern is more about going forward. And I think that's where we want to think about it, because we've got this huge amount of reserves that have been created, and over $2 trillion worth. So that's where the action is what's going to happen going forward. And the answer to that is, it's the same as always, that the Fed can rein in inflation by raising interest rates at the appropriate time. It's just going to do it differently. Now, what do I mean by that? I mean that because we can now pay interest on the reserves that the banks are holding, the banks can hold a very large amount of reserves, as large as they're holding right now, and we can still control the inflationary impulses we can stop those reserves from leaking out into the system, creating inflationary impulses by paying interest on them. So this is actually a very similar, in fact, to Friedman had a very classic article on the optimum quantity of money, where he essentially talked about having the money supply shrink at a particular rate, but the equivalent of that is to pay interest on the money itself. And that's what we have the power to do. So the question, it's The fact we have a large amount of reserves doesn't change the question you should always ask about Fed policy. Will the Fed raise rates in a timely enough fashion to prevent inflation? I think you should always ask a question. Is the right question to ask your central banker? My answer is yes. But the size of the balance sheet does not change our ability to do that, because we can pay interest on that balance sheet. We can pay interest on those reserves.
Now, we've had a very accommodative fiscal policy. So the question is, if you have preconditions, but given the model, the way you formulated it, to reduce unemployment, unless, I guess, the deficits were not large enough that we've been running, most people seem to think that there was anything to do with it.
So the question that was being asked is about there was very accommodative fiscal policy as well being followed. Why didn't we see that reduce unemployment? So in this model, there's many kinds of fiscal policies in the world. So here, you want to be dividing two kinds of fiscal policies. One is product demand stimulus, and I would say, loosely speaking, a lot of the policies that were followed took that form. And then the other would be labor demand stimulus, which is direct subsidies for hiring. Okay? Those are two different kinds of policies. And what this model says is that, let's see where I say it, there's a limit to what product demand stimulus can do, the same limit that the Fed faces. So in order to get beyond that point, you would have to use this other kind of stimulus, which is direct subsidies in the labor market itself. So not just buying more goods or reducing sales taxes on particular kinds of goods, but rather actually going out and subsidizing hiring more directly.
Yeah. I want to thank you for coming. I'm a student, so I come at this more from a layperson's perspective. You talked about the dual mandate and how in the U.S. we have that. In many other countries, central banks do not have a dual mandate. I was wondering, do you think that the dual mandate is the correct policy from a monetary perspective? And do you think that Fed policy during the Great Recession would have been different had there been no dual mandate in the United States?
So let me take the second part of the question. The first part of the question is really not my job in some sense. That's really Congress's job. We're set the mandate by Congress, and we're happy to do whatever they want us to do. But let me talk about the second part of the question, which is, would the Fed policy have been different over the last 4 or 5 years if we'd had a single mandate, just in terms of keeping prices at 2%? And there, I feel, you never know for sure in a counterfactual, but I feel very confident in saying the answer is yes to that. Because basically, the Fed has faced challenges in keeping inflation at the 2% level. If you look at the consensus forecast from the Federal Open Market Committee from January, they're forecasting that inflation is going to be below 2% over the next couple of years. That would argue, just that observation alone might well argue in favor of even more accommodation than they have in place. So that even if you just had a single mandate, I think the Fed's policies would have been quite similar. At a qualitative level, a number of the countries that have had single mandates, I think of the Bank of England in particular, have ended up following policies at least qualitatively similar to what the Federal Reserve has. So I think it's an interesting time to have brought up. This is very, you brought up a question that many people are interested in right now. I think it's an interesting time to be interested in that question, because this is not a time where I think the consensus of the committee is such that they feel a conflict between the mandates at all. They feel that unemployment is too high and inflation is too low. So there's not really a conflict between the two mandates at all at this point in time. So at this moment, I think the answer is, with a single mandate, I think Fed policy would have been very much the same.
Topics, favorite topics were lender last resort and financial innovation. And those are tools beyond the two gross mandates. But they're associated with uncertainty, especially in the product markets. At this point, one of the constraints has been Dodd-Frank. One of the constraints of policymaking has been done for you. Can you tell us how you perceive lender of last resort going into the future and financial innovation policies?
Well, financial innovation policies is, I think a simple answer is, it's going to be hard for me to forecast effectively at a year or 2 year horizon, let alone trying to think about the interaction of financial innovation and policy over a longer period of time. But let me say a couple of words about lender of last resort. So the Federal Reserve during the 2007 through 2010 period undertook a number of interventions under the rubric, really, of lender of last resort. And that included traditional discount window lending. It included term auction facility loans, which are very similar to discount window lending. And then a number of so-called 13-3 interventions, special liquidity interventions. A number of these are still preserved under Dodd-Frank. The discount window remains the same, except with the requirement now that information about those loans have to be released with a two-year lag. The 13-3 facilities, as long as they're broad-based, so they're broad market-based interventions, and most of the interventions the Fed did would fell into that classification. Those the Fed could still undertake. They would have to be approved though by the Secretary of the Treasury, as they would have been in this time frame. I feel relatively confident in saying. What the Fed is no longer allowed to do under Dodd-Frank is specific firm-based interventions of the kind that, say, facilitated the purchase of Bear Stearns in March of 2008, and also facilitated the takeover or the bailout of AIG in September of 2008. Those kinds of interventions are now off the table. That, I think, was not, with hindsight at least, I will say, I don't view those as having been lender of last resort interventions. What those were an attempt to buffer the financial system against what was perceived to be the risk of a calamitous failure, because they didn't really have a mechanism for an orderly resolution of a large financial institution like Bear Stearns or like AIG. Dodd-Frank builds in that kind of mechanism. They have, and that work is ongoing to make that law into reality. So that the point, that the act, I think, does two things that are complementary to each other. It removes the Fed's ability to intervene on a firm, specific basis, which I think is a good thing. And at the same time, it removes the need for that, by now providing, I think, a mechanism for orderly liquidation of large financial institutions. So that's, I think, the there are challenges with making that second piece work. I'm not going to deny that. But that is the way the act, the vision underlying the act. I'm going to go to someone else, Stuart.
One of the impacts of the Great Recession is that basically, financial retirement packages kind of took a big hit. And that actually delayed the retirement of a lot of people, which unfortunately had the impact of actually broadening the labor supply. How might that have impacted part of your model?
Yeah, so this is an effect that is, I had this little throwaway line at the beginning that said, I'm assuming there are no income effects on labor supply. That is exactly what I'm leaving out. The idea that when people's wealth goes down, they become more willing to work is what's being left out of this. I think that when you look at the data on this, you hear anecdotes about this all the time. Those effects turn out to be relatively small in the aggregate. It's not over the long term there have been declines in labor force participation among younger citizens and increases in labor force participation ongoing among our older citizens. And in fact, what's happened during the Great Recession is that rate of increase in labor force participation among 55 plus, for example, has actually slowed. So it's not you. This is a and you definitely. I mean, absolutely, there are people who have made the decision, the calculus that you describe, but it's not really one that bulks large when you look at the data. Yeah.
You spoke as to why we have fewer startups today. And to the list that you mentioned, I'd like to add one, which is business uncertainty, which I have never seen greater. Uncertainty as to future taxes, future tax rates, future energy costs due to EPA regulations, and most significantly, due to future healthcare costs. So it makes it difficult for any business to start up or add labor in any event in this environment. Is that correct?
Certainly, these are things we hear mentioned all the time when we talk to potential entrepreneurs. They're worried about a number of the uncertainties that you highlight. But at the same time, I think that this is one factor that's going on. I highlighted another factor, which I think is also important, which is the fact that many potential entrepreneurs really don't have their own capital to put into their businesses at this point because of the decline in their home values, because of the decline in other assets, the value of other assets they're holding.